Hey guys, how are you both doing tonight?
Well, I'm ready to get my thinking cap on, strap into my Veritech fighter, and take on some Zentradi. Ready to go.
The kids are currently in bed. I just washed my hand after the youngest used the potty. So for now, I'm free. Until it's the next time for dad duty.
You're listening to Board Again Games Season 2, Episode 14, as we talk with designing duo Dr. Witz, made up of Austin Smokowitz and Aaron Hunzowitz, as they get ready to release their new game, Robotech Reconstruction. We talk about game design, some of their favorite gaming experiences, and what it means to play a good game. Thanks for listening, and happy gaming.
Austin and Aaron, who together collectively are Dr. Witz. I'm pronouncing that wrong. Dr. Witz. I'm having trouble with the CTZ.
I am Austin Smokowitz.
Yep.
He is Aaron Hunzowitz. Together, we are Dr. Witz.
Perfect.
Now, is there any particular field of medicine, or is this like a PhD doctor that you guys got?
I have a PhD in economics. But we started calling ourselves Dr. Witz long before that because one of our friends, good friend Paul Owen, already thought one of us had a doctorate. So he started assuming that we were doctors. So we just went with it when he bestowed us his honorary title of Dr. Witz. And we've been very proud to have that. So really, this is from the University of Paul Owen.
Okay. But I still feel obligated at this point to call you Dr. Aaron, because you earned that title, right?
Yes. He has definitely earned that title. And it's always great when people come to me and accidentally call me doctor. I'm like, oh, well, thank you. I didn't know. I'm so happy. It's a great honor.
So together you are the creators of the game Robotech Reconstruction, which is not Battletech. Ryan and I are both very unfamiliar with Robotech, so why don't one of you give us a quick breakdown of the anime that is very popular in some areas that we didn't know about called Robotech, and then we can talk about your game.
I knew about it.
Okay, he knew about it. I didn't.
I knew of its existence.
And yeah, we'll start there. What is Robotech about? Why is it... why is it not?
Yes, Stargrave? I was ordering Stargrave. Yes. Yep. How far back do you want to go? So Robotech has one of those very, you know, only from Japan type backstories, because there was a show called Super Defense Force Macross that was then taken and repurposed as Robotech. And then they took another show and they bolted that onto the end of Super Defense Force Macross. And then they took another show and bolted that onto the end of that one. So you have this long 3-season show from the 80s that comprised of three different intellectual properties that was then completely reworked and makes sense all the way through and tells one very cohesive, very cool storyline that spans multiple decades in time. So the basic premise is that shortly after World War III in the 90s, a spaceship crashes to Earth and the Earthlings are like, what is this thing? So that ends up being what's called the SDF-1, which is a giant alien ship that is also amalgamated with air. They bolt aircraft carriers to it. The story itself for the whole first part of it is the story of the aliens trying to get their ship back. Because anime BS that happens. The ship, when it crashed on Earth, it actually went back 10 years in time, giving the humans enough time to renovate the ship and get it up and running by the time the aliens finally showed up to try to get it.
Okay.
Sending them on a cross-galaxy chase. No. So there's a lot there, but the basis of it is that you have humans and you have these alien Zentradis, and the humans are on this makeshift ship fighting off the Zentradi or fighting off these Zentradi aliens.
That makes sense.
That makes sense.
All right.
My notes here says that Alpha suits are better than Veritech suits. Alpha fighters are greater than Veritech fighters. These might be hot. These might be hot takes.
That's sounds like a hot take. Well, we're dealing with so the game of reconstruction, of Robotech reconstruction, takes place right near the end of that first arc. So I'm not sure those Alpha suits were around yet. So Veritech fighters are still king.
Okay.
How prominent of a role is Lin-Min-Mei in your game?
Lin-Min-Mei. Okay. So
in the game, yeah.
I'm gonna say this. I have a lot of sympathy for Min-Mei. I have a lot of sympathy for Min-Mei. For those who don't know, Min-Mei is both a pop idol in the show who sings songs and is involved in a love triangle with our hero Rick Hunter. But the thing is this: Min-Mei is such a good singer that she makes these Zentradi warriors feel things that they've never felt before. And so that confuses them because they've only known war and battle and, you know, military, but now they like feel love and they have no idea how to process this. So here's this poor girl who is literally being used as a weapon of war through her broadcasting of her songs to the enemy.
I mean, I don't know why I've never watched this. This all sounds amazing.
So there are original songs in the show itself. But for this game, for reconstruction, you're now at a point where the war is over and she is still a very influential character, right? And so you're now living on Earth after the Robotech War, which, to be fair, did kill 90% of the human population. But because they didn't kill all of us and they wanted to kill all of us, we count that as a victory. That's a win in our book. You know, we survive, right? So in this post-war world, you have Lin-Min-Mei still around, still doing her idol thing, and actually keeping the remnants of the Zentradi in line through their devotion to her. And in the game, she is the symbolic figurehead of an entire faction who wants to get civilian control back from the Robotech Defense Force, the RDF, the military, who's essentially has had their part of the world under martial law for the last 2 years, you know, to do things like, you know, just restabilize the Earth's atmosphere after it had been bombarded from space, to make sure that, you know, trees and plants can grow. But the civilian population wants to be, you know, now that things have settled down a little bit. And yes, this is only 2 years. And one of the things that's really fascinating about the show is just how fast humans build. Like, humans will build entire cities within a couple of months within this show. Heck, the very first time that they have to rebuild Macross is within like a week. They rebuild society within the giant mech out in space. That's now out in Pluto. Long story, but you know. Min-Mei plays a prominent role. Is it like 32 episodes? It's like a season.
Sometimes I get turned off because I get like that Naruto worry. You know, oh yeah, you should watch Naruto. Like, man, isn't that like 300,000 hours long?
Yeah. No, the show's really good in the sense that like every 9 or 10 episodes, they're on to like another little mini arc. Like, things keep moving, things keep happening. It's really cool in that regard. It hooks you in and keeps changing along the way.
Is Lancer in the game? Or is this later on? Lancer Yellow Dancer?
Lancer Yellow Dancer?
He might be in the third season.
Yeah, no, Lancer Yellow Dancer is not in this game.
Because the game only covers
nine episodes of the show.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, so the world gets destroyed and they get defeated in the first 9 episodes.
No. This is the last 9 episodes. Oh, so it takes like 28 episodes to get to that point. And then you have you suddenly cut 2 years forward in time after the big battle to then do this. And this is the little end cap for that first season of Robotech.
Gameplay's asymmetrical-ish.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So in this game, I know. So in this game, you have 4 asymmetric factions, right? So like we said, it's 2 years later, and you have all of these aliens and trotties that are, you know, that have been traditionally warlike and, they only know military culture, being civilians for the first time. The civilian world is completely foreign to them, but a lot of them, thanks to Minmay and thanks to now being stranded on Earth after some of them have, been crash landed after the battle, have been trying to take up a civilian life, and this is new to them. And for the last 2 years, things have been pretty good. Times have been hard, but they've been rebuilding. But now we're 2 years later, and they're starting to become discontented, and so what you have are these 4 different factions. You have the Robotech Defense Force, whose main goal is to just keep these Zentradi civilians happy and content and keep things moving along. That's their main goal. But meanwhile, you have Commander Chiron. Commander Chiron is a Zentradi warrior that was part of the Robotech War and had survived, but has been hiding out. At first, he's like in Antarctica for 2 years, and then he moves to like the Amazon rainforest after that. But he's been hiding out for the last 2 years trying to rebuild strength. And his spies have told him that the people are starting to get restless. So he's like, now is the time that I will rise up and we will destroy these. They call them Micronians because humans are our size, and Zentradi warriors are 4 or 5 stories tall. They are gigantic creatures. They are a gigantic race of people. So they call us Micronians. And he's like, it is time to rise up and crush the Micronians. They're a separate faction, and their goal is to just get these Zentradi civilians angry and get them back into battle uniform and to take back, and to take over the world. Then you have, like I mentioned, the AUL, the Anti-Unification League. This is a group of cities that have now sprouted up across North America and are wanting independence from the RDF. And they're like, we've had enough of your military rule. We want to be independent. We want to have our own little city state governments. And so that's your third faction. And then you have a fourth faction, which are alien Zentradis who defected during the final battle, who decided that, we're going to stick with these humans. They're going to be better for us. But these defecting alien Zentradi, they know that there are other threats out in the universe that are going to be coming for Earth. And so the best defense is to keep Earth together. And so their goal is to try to keep everybody, just to try to take all of the, is to basically stop the AUL from splintering humanity into a bunch of different factions and keep everything underneath the RDF, because they're the military. Of course, that's what you do. You know, that just makes sense to them.
I like this.
Yeah. So depending on which faction you play, you have your own set of goals, but you also have to be, very aware and very cautious of how the other players are advancing their goals as well. You can't just put your head down and say, well, I'm going to do this because this is best for me. Because if you do that, then you're just going to get blindsided by somebody else coming along and taking the game from you, taking the win.
So, walking through the rules with you tonight, the game has a very... Have you seen anything from it? Did you see any of the images or anything, Ryan?
Yeah, I went to the BGG page.
Okay. So it has a very bright look to the aesthetics of the board. It's nice. But it seems like it plays more like a coin game. So it's pretty cool in that there's all this asymmetrical balancing and cards events that happen and things like that. So we talked a little bit beforehand about how you came to design the game. Do you want to share something about that? About like what came first, IP or mechanics? And Aaron or Austin can go here. Yeah, or both. Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I assume you guys designed it in the 90s before the IP stuff went happened, or maybe the 80s, and then you've been holding on to it for the IP stuff to be resolved.
No, I think it's, I think for anybody who seriously wants to publish a game, if you start off by saying, I'm going to make an IP game, well, you better have the right contacts with the right people, or it might just stay a thing that's in your house with the friends that you like to play with, because it is, you know, it's difficult to get an IP game out there unless you do know and have those connections. Like, I feel very lucky that it just so happened that one of the rights holders would go to like a design game night that I would go to. And after I found that out, I'm like, oh, that's really cool. You know, those type of opportunities don't come along very, very often. So it's like, well, let me take a look. So like, I'm not I can talk for a long time about the show, but it's not like I haven't been a super long fan of the show. Like this game started development back in 2018. And I have to say that I had only really first watched the show like the year prior to that. And I was, you know, instantly hooked. I'm like, oh, this still, you know, it was made in the early 80s, but it still holds up. Like it has, you can see how the stuff that happens in that show has a lineage to things that are still, you know, that are still being produced today. So like it's mm-hmm. it still holds up, and it's still really good in that way. And by the way, you can watch it for free if you want, just Google it. So really the IP part came first, and then things flowed from there, right? And you know, you're correct in you're saying that it's coin-ish, it's coin-like. We don't use the same, you know, we don't use the same mechanics as coin, but when you watch this part of the show, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, it's not a pitched space battle between two absolutely known forces. It's like small actions, it's insurgent actions. The Zentradi rebellion are doing acts of terrorism on Christmas Eve. They stuff Santas full of bombs. It's very, yeah. And so like, you know, you get that stuff happening. You have independence movements, and it's like, well, what, you know, the game itself kind of arises from those conditions of mm-hmm. like, this is, you know, one of the things that I do like about the Robotech community is that they do treat this very seriously. You know, this game takes place in the far future of 2013. And, you know, we have to take that as it is, but you treat it seriously. Like it is the far future of that time, and that the events that are laid down actually happened. And that actually gives you a great basis for putting one of these together. Now I feel like I'm rambling.
No, it's better you than me. I can go.
Well, so you had the IP, you liked the IP. How did you start? How did the two of you start getting into the design of the game and bringing out those mechanics? Like you said, some of them come out naturally, but without giving everything away, I'm going to say her name wrong. Min May. Yeah, that was. Falling through the rules with you, that was one of the things I really like. I like a sliding, what's alliance type of thing that's going on, and in any game, especially a war game. But she can redistribute balance there with what she's doing. So, like, how did you come up with that? Did that come up because of who she is, or because you needed it in the game? And that's very generic sounding, because I'd rather you guys explain it.
it's not generic sound. I mean, it's not generic at all, because like in the game, in the show, there is a point where Min May goes missing, and that makes the nightly news. that is a big story in the world. So in the game, I'm like, okay, so there's an event. Minmay goes missing. Okay, so that's an event. What will happen when Minmay goes missing? The AUL gets to put a whole bunch of soldiers out into a space, out into a territory, because it's a search party, because they're looking for her. They think she's just disappeared off the face of the planet and they need to find her, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the events flow from, you know, do come from that part of the show and saying, how does it connect? How can it connect back to this game in a way that makes, you know, that makes as realistic sense as possible, both from a lore and show perspective, but also from a game perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, and then I could talk about, like, you know, if you want to get like more designery, right? If we want to go in the more designer questions, it's like, well, what was the ultimate goal for this game? Well, these types of comm sim games, they're asymmetric. They take a long time to play. But the idea was, let's try to make it be able to be played out as, you know, be able to play out as fast as possible, to have a full game, but have it stay, like, my goal was like, hey, let's make this game 90 minutes. Let's make this a 90-minute game and make that work. You know, it can easily slip into two, you know, it's really more of like a two-hour game, but like compared to other games in the genre, this is a very slimmed down, this is a lighter, this is a faster game for that. And that was definitely a design goal, because we know that this is going to be pitched to a lot of Robotech fans who may be war gamers, who may not be war gamers, who may not be familiar at all with mm-hmm. this type of gameplay, where, you know, you have to learn the game four times in order to play it. It's like, well, no, you got to learn your one first, and then you can, you know, move on and see the conflict from another perspective a little later on. But like as a way to try to make it as introductory as possible was absolutely one of the main design goals. And at every turn, the question was, how do we simplify? How do we make this as not as complicated as possible, while still getting in all of that flavor from the show, so that the Robotech fans who know the show are able to look at the card and go, oh yeah, that is what would happen. Okay, cool. Now I get to do a thing on the board that is reflective of a thing that happened in the show.
Yeah, yeah. What the first game that actually came to mind that I hadn't thought of but before you were going through the rules was Root, actually, more than typical war games, more than historical war games. What types of games have you both played as you designed this that kind of influenced the design of this game?
Well, I can say that on the one hand, I've played Root. You know, I have played Root too. I mean, I've played Root. I've played other coin games. I have to imagine that there is some influence there. But like one of the things that like Aaron and I both like, I don't really want to talk for him, but one of the things that Aaron and I both like are these games where you have to, like, it's a terrible term because I made it up and nobody else says it, but it's like, it's a 50-50 game, where half of the game is on the table and the other half of the game is above the table. Like, okay. Aaron and I both love the game Diplomacy. And okay. That's a game where half of the game's on the table, the other half. I see you have Dune on your shelf.
Yeah.
Right. Dune is another great game where, yeah, you got a lot of stuff going on the table, but it's just equally important to have the stuff happening above the table.
Yeah.
And for Robotech Reconstruction, I put it like, you know, 60, I put it at like 60-40. Like there's a lot of stuff happening on the table, but it is just as important what's going on above the table. You need to be able to influence, you know, you need to be able to talk to and influence the other players at the table to do something that is in their interest, but maybe in your interest a little bit more. And And I don't want to say that it's not really a backstab. You know, this is not a game where you're going around and backstabbing people. You know, it's not a game that doesn't make, you know, it's not a game that kills friendships. It's not anything like that, because it's too fast. Things happen too quickly. And usually whenever you're doing something, you just advance your own goal. You don't necessarily turn around and completely curb stomp somebody else
right
in the process.
Yeah.
You know, so like it is very possible for the game to end and have a winner, but like have two people who have reached their goal, but because they were not able to stop somebody else who went earlier in the round, then that player still wins, even though you also completed what you meant to do, but you couldn't do it before somebody else did.
Right. Yeah.
So like it is that, so it's like, it's those types of games that also have also heavily influenced this, along with, yes, other asymmetric games that are out there, but it's really more of this feel that we're trying to get across.
No, that's interesting.
I mean, asymmetric games are like, usually if you're like, hey man, I got this game, it's asymmetric, I'm pretty much like, I'm in. That's like my number one thing that I like is asymmetric, followed by, I don't know, Euro. But so you've mentioned diplomacy. I have, I've never had any friends, so I didn't have any friends to lose to play diplomacy with. Because it is, I've heard the game. There was I don't know if you've heard this. It was on NPR. It was, what's the show with Ira Glass?
This American Life,
where they talked to diplomacy players. It was only like a 5-15 minute episode. It was amazing. And you guys played a lot of diplomacy, right?
That's right. Really wanting Aaron to step in here. He's got some good stuff to say.
Yeah. I mean, if you, baby duties happens, man, I get it. We've all lived that life. So how do I get people to play diplomacy with me?
Okay. No, and I'm being serious here. I played this, like Aaron and I played diplomacy back in high school, right? And we had a group, we had a regular group that we played with. There was like 9-10 people. So not everybody was available for a diplomacy game. So, you know, you'd have different amalgamations of 7 and we would get together once a month, you know, back in high school to play it. And afterwards, when I went off to college, I introduced the game to a couple of different, you know, to my friends as well. And I was able to get them to play it. But I did two things. First of all, I did not necessarily use the original diplomacy map. With a smaller group, I used a 5-player Lord of the Rings map because they were big into Lord of the Rings at the time. So I'm like, okay, who wants to play as Sauron? Who wants to play as the Ents? Who wants to play as the elves?
You play as the Ents in this map?
Play as the Ents. The Ents are like Austria-Hungary. You play as the Ents, but you're like surrounded. And and so during that game, my friend who was playing the Ents are like, trees slow, moving slowly through. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is you got to make a rule change. There's only one, it's one rule change, but it drastically changes the end game and makes it a lot better for people. I know it's against, you know, it's not in the rules, so it's heresy, but this works. You have to play the game by adding the rule that says at the end of a winter phase, at the end of a winter, and for people who play the game, you'll be able to follow on. At the end of a winter, half or less of the players, if half or less of the players control 2/3 or more of the supply centers and agree, they can declare a joint victory.
Okay.
So what this means is that in a 7-player diplomacy game, two or three people who control about, I think it's like 23 supply centers are able to declare the game over. And now what this does, because again, we did this all the time back in high school. What this meant is that within 6 hours, you could have two people eliminated and a 3-player alliance come out as a victor, as a victory. And then the game is short enough. Friendships are not ruined because you have a joint victory. There was this awesome, awesome time. This one time I was playing as Turkey and I had been fighting Austria-Hungary and Russia the entire game, and they had whittled me down to one supply center. But because they had decided to also push westward at the same time, we got to a winter where they're like, oh no, we're one supply center short from the, hey, would you like to join our alliance to win the game? And I was sitting on one supply center and said, yes, because I had been fighting them the entire game in my little corner, but I still got to declare victory. That was a good game. Very memorable too.
I like this.
Interesting.
I want to play.
So yeah, how do you both define a good game? And then we'll talk about your goals in designing your current game. How do you define a good game then?
Players playing players.
Players playing players. Okay, what does that mean?
So the whole experience is about us trying to outwit, outsmart, outnegotiate, outbluff, but we're outdoing each other. We're not being dictated what's going on by some outside thing other than to give us a situation where we have to deal with each other. The whole point of playing a game is to deal with other people around me. And if I weren't here to deal with other people, then I could play a solitaire game. And there's lots of good solitaire games, but what stuff that we're really doing a lot of is about me playing with you and whoever else is in the room. So we're playing against each other, with each other, something, but we're dealing with each other. It's about our interactions with the people there.
Yeah, I mean, I can feel that in the design of your game and in the games that we're coming out here talking about tonight. I mean, this is a very big divide in gaming, right, about what a good game is, because some people, some people only want to play a Euro game where you are maximizing your efficiency, right? And they don't like the type of thing that you're talking about. Is there a way to bridge that divide between players playing players, as you put it, and maximizing efficiency?
Well, I mean, there are Euro-style games with lots of interaction with each other. So I don't see that's mutually exclusive.
Sure.
But I also don't see that people have to have this, like, the same things. Like, part of what makes board gaming fun is the diversity of what people enjoy doing. So I'm not saying I'm trying to make a game that everyone likes. I'm not. I understand people like different things. I'm happy for that. So it's not necessarily about bridging the gap, but being appreciative of both styles or other styles as well. It's appreciating the nuances in those styles. And that's, I think, more important than finding the groups that want to enjoy those styles that have access to the games that make them happy. So there are some great Euro designers, some great solo designers. There are some great people who really good social production games. And that's wonderful. And by having that diversity in design, they're serving up the diversity of the audience we have, because not everyone wants to play the same thing. And we need to allow a lot of things to exist to be able to have everyone find a game that fits them.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's very well said. And I like this, but I'm going to push more. I like what you said. I do. What do you say to those, though, who say, if you don't play a game, and this will push back on what Austin said too, and this isn't my opinion but there are game designers who say, if you don't play games by the rules and by the constructs that are there, you're not really playing games. What's your response to them, either of you? I mean,
are they having fun doing what they're doing?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Are they having fun doing what they're doing? Are they enjoying themselves? Are they feeling challenged? I mean, as long as the players are happy with what they have, as long as they're not physically hurting someone else, it's not my position to question what they're doing. It's my job as a designer to give them avenues that may or may not have thought of before or make it easier to do it certain ways. But it's not my job as a designer to say, you must play Monopoly with no money and free parking. Now, I might have my own personal opinion or not that game plays better or worse that way. But honestly, there are people who like doing that, and that's good for them, and that's good for the hobby. And going after people for playing it differently, where you're mean about it, is not very welcoming. But that doesn't mean there isn't room for critique. Like, Monopoly does play differently. You put money on free parking versus when you don't. And that does create different experiences. And so, you know, people say, if I want a different experience in Monopoly, well, sure. If they want a different experience in Monopoly, we can tell them things they can do. But they don't have to do it. It's their choice. It's their opportunity to create their experiences, whether on purpose or by accident. But that's just part of the fun of board gaming.
We always played with money on free parking. I don't think I actually understood what Monopoly was until I got older and got into gaming. And then now I look back on it, and there's a really big spreadsheet, if you guys ever want to look it up, of like how to win Monopoly.
Oh.
God, Dr. Aaron knows what I'm talking about because he's an economist. Maybe. I don't know if that actually overlays.
Don't underestimate Austin's mathematical ability.
Yeah. You just want to land on the space.
Totally underestimate it. Completely.
This is just try to buy all the spaces around free parking because it's a dice rolling game. So like 7 is like the most average number. So the most likely place that people land are on the areas, the orange and the red ones. Specifically the orange one, St. James Place, that's like one of the highest landed on through probability. Because since there's cards that send you back to go, then you restart. So you're more frequently falling in on that spectrum of rolling. So you develop those first, and you're probably going to win.
All right.
And buy everything.
Buy everything. All right. Yeah.
That's why I don't play Monopoly with my kids anymore. They're 8 and 4, and I just trounce them. I'm like, get out of my house. So
my niece and nephew play Fortnite Monopoly. I have like 3 different points to go off of your question. Like there's so much to talk about here.
Yeah. Right?
When we talk about this, because first of all, like when was the last time you played a party game where the people were really sitting around being like, oh, these points really matter in this party game? No, they're there having fun playing the game.
Yeah.
I can think of like one game where we quasi cared about the points, which was Monikers, where at the end we're like, how many points are we back? We're only back by like 3 points. Okay, we can do this. But it's more of just a rallying cry. And then what the final total was, I don't know. Don't care, because it's a fun game.
Yeah.
There's that. There's the second thing is this idea that there's this idea that when somebody hands you a rule book, what they're saying is that if you play this game with these materials by these rules, you will have fun, right? That's kind of like a promise from the designer to the player. And if you do it this way, you will have fun. But as I had noted in my diplomacy story, we changed a rule. Like we changed a rule that worked for us, but we know that not everybody would be on board with it. But it worked for a bunch of high schoolers who only had an afternoon to play a game.
Yep.
And the third thing is that one of the things that you'll hear, you know, with designers, as designers talk to other designers, is this idea of this little phrase called not for me. Because every person has their own tastes and things that they like and that they look for in a game. They can play somebody else's game and then say, well, this game is not for me, or this is not my type of game. Like for me, anything that has to do with words, any word game, any game where I have to manipulate words or spell words, I go, this game is not for me, but I will still play it and I will still try to look at it and critique it like a game. Like, is it doing what the designer is asking? You know, is it doing what they want to do? Are the systems still working? You know, there's a lot of different analytical, there's a lot of different analytical ways for me to look at a game besides just, you know, if it is for me or not for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will not invite you to my Boggle tournament.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I would only make two letter combinations as B, the.
Well, so circling back to your guys' game, because tell me more about your goals in designing the game, because I think that was really clear as you talked about it tonight, your passion for this experience that you both keep talking about. Even in the first play, I think your game has some great things going for it. So go ahead and talk about your goals, if you could, as far as what you want somebody to experience when they play the game.
Okay. So this is a game that has four different factions, and it's got a rule book, and we're putting together a how to play video. And like, if you are new to this experience, there can be a lot to get through. So part of the design goal was to try to make that as easy as possible while still getting across, while still having the thematic element to get people into the game, which is something that I've already discussed this evening. But not only that, not only do we want to try to keep the bar to entry as low as possible, there's this thing where this game does rely a lot on about that above the table play and players trying to balance each other out and reacting to what each other is doing around the table. So if it's the first time you're playing, you don't know what all the events are in the event deck. You don't know what could be coming your way. Now, the event deck is not that large. You know, there's the same, we've separated the deck so that there's the same kind of top 17 cards that get dealt out at the beginning of every game. So you play it a couple times, you see the cards, you know, you see the starting cards, you have a good feel for what's out there and what's available. But if you don't, and if it's new to a group, you'll get through it. You'll be surprised. The balance might not be there, and then the game will end at the end of the second round. So this is a four-round game, but it is possible for the game to end early. So if things are unbalanced or the table has skewed too far, too quickly, the game ends and it comes to a conclusion and people don't have to sit there and agonize as they're like, oh, we got two more rounds of this. We're going to be here another hour, but it's clear, you know, it's clear this guy's won. But no, the game will be like, no, you've won. Congratulations.
So the AUL can win at the end of turn two.
any faction.
I'm not going to play the other factions.
Any faction can win at the end of round two. Though it's going to be really tricky for the Zentradi Rebellion to win at the end of round two. The Zentradi Rebellion has to play a longer game. And because of that, they're more interested in any faction to like make sure that the AUL doesn't win at the end of round two. They have to be a little bit more coy in how they're balancing the other three factions at the table so that the game does, they can win in round three.
Okay.
So like, you know, they can win in round three. They just need to get there.
So the more experienced players should play the Zentradis to start off with to help make sure. My second favorite thing on games is, first favorite thing is asymmetrical. Second favorite is varying turn lengths. Even more alternate win conditions or win conditions happening earlier, ending the game early. You know, I just...
Boy, you just described our game.
This is...
yeah, let me tell you an interesting thing about this game. So one of the things about this game is that there's four rounds. In each round, each player gets to take a turn. But you are highly incentivized to play event cards of other factions. Each event card only has one faction's event on it. And again, these are things that happen in the show. And it's like, the way you kind of treat it is that all of these things happen but only some of them are more important this time around to how events shape out. And what this does, though, is that when you play the event card of somebody else, they essentially get to take over for a little bit, and they get to execute the stuff on the event card. You know, one of the things that a player can easily miss is they're like, oh, I'm going to play in a, you know, I am the RDF. I'm going to play an AUL card, and they're going to do this, 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 and that. And then you have to go, no, actually the AUL gets to decide what happens. And they go, no, wait a minute. No. Maybe I don't want that to happen. within a round, each player gets to take a turn, but then conversely, you're going to have 2 to 3 other players be able to take actions and continue pursuing their goals out of the normal turn order. And what's really cool about that is that if somebody has like fallen behind and it's pretty obvious that they're behind, people will start playing their event cards because they think it's safe. And that quickly I've seen players go from almost completely out of it to suddenly on the verge of winning because they had a round where everybody was like, oh, well, they're not doing anything. I'm going to play one of their event cards. So they got a benefit, and then they got a benefit, and then they got a benefit. And then they're like, well, I'm back, and I'm an equal threat, and you have to worry about me just like everybody else. It's a system in that way.
Before I interrupt again, or before we continue, I always have to do something. So now that I'm excited for the game, when and how do I buy it?
In the first week of June, pre-orders will open up.
Yes.
The pre-orders will be at Strange Machine Games website.
Christopher will put that on the thing. I always like to mention that.
Yeah.
Just so then he has to.
So Strange Machine...
StrangeMachineGames.com.
Yeah, Strange Machine.
You can put yourself on an email list right now if you see this before the first week in June. But if you're seeing it after, you can go right now to StrangeMachineGames.com.
So is it? I was unclear. Is it like a P500 type situation or?
Yes. Okay. But it's. 200.
Okay.
Instead of 500.
Cool. Well, it sounds like you have some good excitement. What I really liked, I was telling Austin this earlier, I really liked the fact that I knew nothing about Robotech, had it completely wrong, but then by him explaining the rules of the game and going through the game and the factions, I felt like I started to have an understanding of the universe and what was going on there. The setting felt very comfortable with the mechanics. So I really like that and want to compliment you both on that. Question we typically ask everybody in every episode, because we're coming near the end of our time together here, is where would you both like to see gaming grow in the next few years? That can be anything from particular games to how you want conventions to happen when they open back up, whatever. But where would you like to see gaming grow?
Let's see. What one of our games we want signed? Austin, Hoboken, New Jersey Syndicate.
Let's get some of our other games out there. We want New Jersey Syndicate to get out there. It could be a completely different name, completely different theme. That's fine. But it's been looked at a lot. It deserves a home.
So we really enjoy seeing development of what we call real world mechanic games that take mechanics that exist in the real world and bring the board games, because there's a lot of interesting things people do in real life that would be fun doing board games. And that's something we do ourselves in a lot of our designs. And so we're excited anytime we see anyone doing that and can tell us that backstory. These mechanics don't always necessarily match the theme of the board game. So we draw New Jersey Syndicate, where you're playing mob families trying to become the new don of the New Jersey mob. And you're just laying some tiles down, trying to figure out some things. But what we don't tell you is that the game is actually based on mortgage-backed securities. And that each town is a different mortgage-backed security. And when you're placing your people down, they're actually different tranches of that mortgage-backed security. But no one knows that unless we tell them it. And generally speaking, we don't tell them. And they just play this game and they have fun. But they don't realize that the mechanics they're playing is a fancy financial instrument from Wall Street. They're just enjoying this neat mechanic that creates a series of information problems. We're trying to figure out if where you put your stuff is a safe place to put your stuff or not, or if it's really just a bad investment of your goons.
So you're playing it's a 2008 financial crisis, the game, reskinned.
As a mob game.
Okay. I like this. I put my head down just because because I also have dabbled in game design, and I have put in things that I don't know if I would tell people for the idea of games. So when you said that, I just fell in love with the concept.
So go ahead. What else would you both like to see in the tabletop and board game design world and just in general in the next few years?
More Dr. Okay. Wicks games.
More Dr. Wicks games. I would, it's a weird thing to say, but I would like to see more experimentation in the legacy format. I would like to see more people try it. It's really difficult. It's a hard thing to do. But like, because, and I say this because the term legacy seems to have taken off, but most games that call themselves legacy actually are not. They're actually just a bunch of expansion packs put together in the same thing, or it's used as an easy way to eventually teach the full game that they're doing, which are both great applications, by the way. It's just, they're not legacy games. And it would be great to see, it continued to be iterated upon. I know it's hard. It's a wish list. It's not going to happen.
So can you give us a better idea? I know that's pretty broad, but could you give us a better idea of what a true legacy game would look like then?
Well, so a true legacy game is one where you are permanently altering the map and permanently altering the components, the map, as you go through it. You know, it's something that essentially is destructible and creates a unique product at the end of the day. And I think for me, this is just because of my, like, I went to school for digital cinema. That's the art side of me speaking out, where it's just like, yeah, let's have more things where people end up with more unique products at the end of the day. But the hard part is, and the reason why legacy games are so hard, is that you want to get to the end because it can't go on forever. You get to the end and then you want to keep playing, and you still are okay with keep playing it. And that's the tricky part there. And so, I don't know if that's necessarily been solved yet, but the only way it will be solved is if people keep working on it and keep innovating on it.
So Austin, yes. Is Yufool Legacy, which is an expansion to our board game called Yufool from Buttonshot Games, is that actually a legacy game or not?
It is a legacy game because you destroy 3/4 of the cards.
Is Iron Man Magic Legacy? That's where Iron Man Magic is when you play, every time one of you, it's an old school variant, every time one of your cards go in the discard pile, you tear it in half.
You actually rip it up. I find it hard to imagine Magic players willingly tearing up their cards like that. Oh, so hard.
Have you ever heard the Chaos Orb story? The guy had to drop the Chaos Orb down and wasn't worried about where it would land, so he cut it up, shredded it into a whole bunch of pieces and dropped it. And the judge came over and was like, okay, yeah, you destroyed all these cards. But then he got banned. He got disqualified because after that his deck was no longer a legal size for the next match. And they made an unglued card about it called, like in the, probably the 90s, called Chaos Confetti or something. Yes, he used to be a Magic player.
That was very niche for those that don't play Magic.
That's great.
anything else that either of you would like to say? We appreciate you both being a part of the show and sharing about the game. I'm looking forward to seeing it come out. 200 is pretty small, so I hope you get immediately second printing or maybe doubled on that 200 if you get enough pre-order interest. So
what's the ballpark on shipping?
We don't have the information on shipping. I mean, the way it'll work is that there's a minimum length it'll stay open. And as long as in that minimum length, we hit at least 200 copies, and with the printing of enough to 200 of the books, then the time period.
Okay,
we're hoping within that minimum length to get to that goal, and then it'd be nice to go beyond it, but it depends what people want.
Yeah.
So get those 200 quick, so I can get my game.
Cool. Anything else, though, that either of you wants to say before we sign off tonight?
Well, thank you for having us on, by the way.
Thank you so much. I know it's weird, and that's our show. It's weird, but thank you so much.
It's weird. I'm fine.
No, it's
absolutely normal. Normal human being. I am not a Zentretti, because I am normal human being size.
Yes, you are a Micronian. Yes.
I'm gonna go home and tell my wife, hey, we've been looking for a show to watch. I'm gonna be like, hey, do you want to watch Macross Robotech? What was the third name? I know there's three shows. I'm like, but it's all
it's just one thing. It's Robotech.
Robotech. I'm gonna watch for stuff too. That's right. I'm watching that. I have to put Star Trek on the back burner.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. You both have a good evening. We'll hopefully see good things from you both soon.
You've just been listening to Board Game Games Season 2, Episode 14, as we talk with Aaron and Austin of Designing Duo, Dr. Wicks, as they talk about their upcoming game, Robotech Reconstruction, as well as what goes into a good gaming experience for them. Join us as we continue to explore the world of tabletop gaming. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Twitch, and YouTube. Thanks for listening to Happy Gaming.